And anyone I catch talking about this young lady will first be beaten to death and then burned alive, and after that be kept on bread and water for 6 weeks.
Bravo, sir.
You're listening to the podcast for those who have looked beyond the edge of the world.
And can't stop talking about it.
Welcome to Talking Beasts.
From NarniaWeb.com.
Where we explore the world of C.S. Lewis.
And keep a watchful eye.
On the latest Narnia movie news,
this is Talking Beasts.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back. I'm your host, Rillian.
And I'm Glumpuddle. Wow, it was a great 2 weeks waiting for this episode.
It was a fabulous 2 weeks. We got so many great comments.
Wow, they were so insightful.
Both on the NarniaWeb.com podcast section and on the Talking Beasts Facebook group. They were great these last 2 weeks.
And for all we know, the New York Times, maybe they picked up the story and had ideas, and because obviously we're just guessing at this point.
Or there could be no New York Times anymore. In fact, this could be World War III, and we would have no clue because we're recording right after our previous episode.
This is our first time doing this. We just finished recording the previous podcast episode about 10 minutes ago. And we're going straight into this one. So hopefully there's still, hopefully an internet still exists to upload this to. We're kind of taking that one on faith.
Well, my caffeine supply still exists, which is how I'm rolling right into the next episode just fine. But I'm good. But no, on the last episode, we had great discussion about meeting Edmund again, meeting Susan again.
Mm-hmm.
The whole plot with the Narnians trying to escape from Tashban, and then, of course, rolling right into Shasta, finally getting to the meeting spot, meeting the cat, which seems, it's just a simple cat. It seems so innocuous at that point in the story.
Uh-huh.
And then Shasta dealing with his fear, and then at the very end of the chapter, finally seeing Bree and Wyn again, and not seeing Erebus until like the last second, wondering what to do, and then finally being reunited with them, and then getting to hear their side of the story for the first time.
And then jumping back in time that way. It's kind of a weird way the book is structured.
Where
it's not quite as extreme as what Prince Caspian does. But yeah, for a moment, it's like, hey, here's Shasta's journey. And then when Erebus arrives, he has no clue how she got here and why she's dressed so fancy and everything. Back in time. Here's how we got to this point.
Yeah, now we're back to chapters 7 and 8, which we're going to discuss in this episode. But before that, and then at the very end of that,
that's okay.
Caffeine is leaving me. And so in this episode, we're going to be discussing chapters 7 and 8. And at the end of this episode, maybe I will be stumped, as you were in the last episode.
I was stumped.
Not
at least
mostly.
I was 25% stumped.
You were only 25% stumped. You got 75%.
That's not bad.
That's good enough for an American education. Okay.
All right, so I'll go ahead and, as you know, you gave me the same courtesy, gave me the episode to mull it over, and I'll extend the same to you. So your question, question will be, on what three objects is... Oh, by the way, this question was submitted by Diggory Kirk.
Thank you, Diggory.
The question is, on what three objects is the deep magic from the dawn of time engraved?
Oh!
But you can't tell me now. You can't tell me now.
No, I won't. I'm going to be in a bad mood the rest of this episode. Just a forewarning.
Okay, and you could accept a hint probably, or you could maybe just try to find it in the book really quick. In this episode, we're now in kind of Erebus's world, and she gets sucked up into Lasserlin's world, which just like Tashban, it looks great on the outside. And
how did you say her name?
I say Lazarleen. Lassarleen.
I say Lasserlin.
I say Lasserlin. Maybe we should just call her Lass or Lassie.
Lassie? Lassie. I like Lassie.
Let's go with Lassie.
Before we go with discussion on Lassie, we'll let the Narnia Nana take us away.
This is Narnia Nana with another Narnia Nugget. Today's reading comes from Chapter 7 of The Horse and His Boy. After watching Shasta be taken away by the Narnians, Erebus has sought refuge from an old friend in the city of Tashban. Although Lasserlin had said she was dying to hear Erebus's story, she showed no sign of really wanting to hear it at all. She was, in fact, much better at talking than at listening. She insisted on Ervis having a long and luxurious bath. Kellerman baths are famous. And then dressing her up in the finest clothes before she would let her explain anything. The fuss she made about choosing the dresses nearly drove Ervis mad. She remembered now that La Seraline had always been like that, interested in clothes and parties and gossip. Ervis had always been more interested in bows and arrows and horses and dogs and swimming. You will guess that each thought the other silly. But when at last they were both seated after a meal, it was chiefly of the whipped cream and jelly and fruit and ice sort, in a beautiful pillared room, which Ervis would have liked better if La Seraline's spoiled pet monkey hadn't been climbing about it all the time. La Seraline at last asked her why she was running away from home. When Ervis had finished telling her story, La Seraline said, "But, darling, why don't you marry Ahashta Tarkan? Everyone's crazy about him. My husband says he is beginning to be one of the greatest men in Kalerman. He has just been made Grand Vizier now old Exartha has died, didn't you know?" "I don't care. I can't stand the sight of him," said Ervis. "But, darling, only think. 3 palaces, and one of them that beautiful one down on the lake at Ilkeen. Positively ropes of pearls, I'm told. Baths of ass's milk. And you'd see such a lot of me." "He can keep his pearls and palaces as far as I'm concerned," said Ervis. "You always were a queer girl, Ervis," said La Seraline. "What more do you want?"
I have to say, La Seraline, I don't know how you say it. Lasserline?
Lassie.
As you would say?
Lassie.
Lassie. Lassie.
That's what we're going with.
I honestly was one of my, probably the most memorable characters for me out of this book. And I'm not really sure why. She's not in the book a whole lot. But I think it's because it kind of takes you back, because I knew so many girls like this in high school and junior high. And it just instantly came to me, like, oh, yes, I know this this type of character.
I would certainly say she's one of the most memorable characters in The Horse and His Boy. And a lot of people, she just stands out in their memory, even though she's only in a couple scenes. But I guess she has so many lines that are maddening, but hilarious. And you almost, almost kind of like her at the same time. One of my favorite lines.
I hate the character, even though she's not exactly a favorite.
Right. One of my favorite lines in all of the Chronicles of Narnia is when she tells one of the servants after Erebus walks in that, oh, basically you can't tell anyone about this. And she says, "And anyone I catch talking about this young lady will first be beaten to death and then burned alive, and after that be kept on bread and water for 6 weeks."
Bravo, sir. You know, they hire voice actors. You could do this as a career.
Voice Lasserline?
Yeah. Or if it's, hey, if she's a new race, if she's an entirely new race and not human like you wanted, then you could do the voice.
If they don't let me just straight up play Lasserline in the movie, I guess I could just dub her. I could just do her looping in post.
Why not? But
heard it here first.
hey, we foretell the future here on NarniaWeb.com. It's true. Look at the April Fool's joke.
It's true. Anyway, we predicted the Caspian Susan kiss, so maybe we predicted Glumpuddle being cast as Lasserline as well.
I predicted the Caspian Susan kiss, my friend. Don't you dare steal what I worked so hard to create and bring about. But no, what's interesting is...
Giving my wife an apologetic look right now.
I have to say, you know, the character of Lasserline, she's humorous and stuff, but... it's kind of an interesting character because she almost reminds me of who Susan becomes in the last battle. And it's and here's the interesting thing, and this is where, I mean, Lewis even says they basically had opposite interests and each thought the other silly. But what makes one character, you know, more fun and the other one not, is it's not, of course, their interest. It's just really the depth of what they want. It's not their interests, it's what they want to pursue in life and what they believe gives their lives meaning.
Right. I think it's and like we talked about in our podcast where we talked about Susan and kind of what all that means. Things like for example, Lassie is obsessed with clothes and parties and things like and palaces and things like that. Those are not in and of themselves bad things, and I don't think the series portrays them that way, because there are plenty of instances of like, you know, Jill keeps her dress at the end of Silver Chair, and that's portrayed as a positive thing. There's plenty of instances of great parties and feasting and, oh, wow, wasn't it these beautiful places they visit? It's not that any of the things that Lassie is into are in and of themselves bad. The problem is that it's those things ultimately don't last. There's nothing wrong with appreciating those things, but it's a shaky thing to kind of base your life on, because you're going to wake up one day and realize those things aren't there anymore. I love what is it that Polly says in the last battle, that Susan has raced to get to the silliest point in her life, and she'll spend the rest of her life trying to stay there. Yeah. These things aren't in and of themselves bad. It's trying to base so much of your life around them that's a trap, because they ultimately don't last.
What's ironic is that the book is considered sexist by 21st century standards, but if you look at Lacerilene and Aravis in terms of, you know, just boom, here's the two portrayed, certainly Aravis is the one that lines up better with a modern positive portrayal of feminism, and, you know, girl power. She's the action hero. She's confident. She's brave. She's intelligent. She's quick witted. She can handle herself. She could easily best Shasta in battle. So I don't know. More of an interest. We get a great point in some ways, but
yeah, I think briefly mentioned in the last episode, Lassie's kind of a picture of what the life Erebus said no to, basically, when she left.
Which I hadn't thought of until, but I think you're right.
Erebus could have stayed and married Ahasha and had the kind of life that Lassie is living. But both characters, you know, we've split up the group now. You have Shasta with the Narnians and Erebus with Lassie. But both Erebus and Shasta encounter characters, and I have to credit Dr. Michael Ward for this one. I heard I watched a talk he was giving on YouTube about The Horse and His Boy, but observes that they both encounter basically almost another version of themselves. Shasta, of course, encountering his twin, and Shasta, had he not been kidnapped, probably would have lived a very similar life to Corrin, and would have been a different king as a result of that. And now we have Erebus meeting an old friend, and this is almost like a second chance for Erebus. She could stay with Lassie, and she could try to maybe make things up with Ahasha and go through with it and have the kind of luxurious life she has. But to Erebus's credit, getting that chance only, I think, furthers her resolve. Like, okay, this is why I'm getting out of here, because as the city of Tashban and even Lassie are both great examples of, it looks great on the outside, it looks wonderful, but then you get there and it's so shallow that you don't want to, this is not the kind of, you don't want to spend your whole life like this. And you got to figure there'll become a tragic point in Lassie's life where, I'm sorry, it is hard to take this too seriously, calling her Lassie, but it's just so much easier than saying Lazarline, whatever. But there'll probably come a point in her life.
Lazarline, it's not that hard.
Say it one more time.
Lazarline.
I kind of miss that A when I say it. It's Lacerilene. Lacerilene.
Yes.
Okay, right here, live recording on the Talking Beast podcast.
How long have you been reading this book and you just now notice?
It's one of those names you read and you just kind of... It's one of those names that you just kind of read and you just kind of mentally buzz over it. I somehow miss that A. It's Lacerilene. Okay. I think I can get through that and not call her Lassie anymore.
You're welcome.
Which I'm sure our listeners will be happy about.
Man, that should have been your stump question. I should have asked you how to spell Lacerilene.
I would have got it wrong. I would have been stumped.
Lacerilene.
So there may come a tragic day when Lacerilene wakes up and I think kind of realizes, oh my gosh, my whole life was built around things that don't last. And that kind of breaks my heart to think of that.
It does, and then I also think about the line, and this is really a great example of it, this portion of the chapter between Erebus and Lacerilene. I love the line from the Magician's Nephew, and I found it very true in life, where Aslan tells Diggory, he says, people always get what they want, they don't always like it.
Uh-huh.
And it's really amazing, because you think, you know, Erebus, if she wanted to marry Ahasta, she could get what she wanted. If she wanted to... If she wanted the lifestyle of Lacerilene, she could get what she wanted. Lacerilene is getting what she wants. She's getting what she asked for. And it's amazing because I've found so many times in life, people are not unhappy because they just had something they wanted and they just couldn't get it. A lot of times they are very unhappy in the life with the person they've chosen, with the work they've chosen, with the just the even little choices, things that they have chosen, lead them to very to great unhappiness. Mm-hmm. Because of course we do such a great job as human beings making wonderful decisions for our lives, but so that kind of ties in here, I think, and you see more of just. I mean, again, there's not really a whole lot I can add. I think you're right. It is a mirror image of what Erebus could have had.
All right.
This is good. This is good.
Very good.
Indeed. We'll be right back for my stumping. And maybe. Before that, we have Voices of Narnia Web and a C.S. Lewis Minute. We'll be right back.
Voices of Narnia Web.
Hi, everyone at Narnia Web. My name is Katie Patchell, and I'm from New York State in the USA. So I was introduced to Narnia when I was a small child. I don't remember it, but my family tells stories of my mother sitting by my bed and reading the whole series to me with voices. I believe her mainly because she still reads to me in different voices. But my earliest memories and the meaningful ones were when I was 10, and this is when Narnia became important. My grandfather died of his third and final heart attack, and months before that, the first movie came out. And this was my first taste of seeing anything epic on the screen. Before that, I had seen Jane Austen movies and classic American movies, which is all amazing, but not necessarily epic. But the CGI and Aslan or Liam Neeson's voice, the snow, the weapons, the music, it all made the story seem so real to me, which proved helpful in the end when 3 months later my grandfather did die. He was my entire world. If you can imagine a mix of Professor Kirk and Aslan in personality, I looked up to him, and when he died, this was my first experience of someone I loved dying. So Aslan especially and the stories just became something that comforted me. I think this was also compounded by the fact that the characters were all around my age, and they go through a journey from a place of the Blitz and this kind of grubby, dark, war-torn reality into a wardrobe to a completely different world. This was what I wanted when I was 10, to open a wardrobe and escape. And I mean, I'm glad that that didn't happen in a way, although I still eye wardrobes with hope. But when I was 10, the books became a refuge for me. And it's funny when I talk to people who say that, oh, it's very outdated, why do you like those stories? But one, I like British things, and two, I love history, and three, I never had that experience at all. Even though the children have a different dialogue than I would hear in my daily life, it's from a different era, but those same jealousies and fights and passions, and they exist. And importantly, the potential to do something great with your life, that's something that I always dreamed of and still dream of. So probably my favorite characters, to be honest, they change with every reading, and it depends on what book or time of life I'm in. I usually have favorite characters every single book. But my two favorite scenes are one in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, when Aslan comes back to life. And one moment it's darkness and death, and the next, everything's good again, in the best sense of the word. And of course there's a battle and victory and all of that. But then the other favorite scene is also Shasta and hearing the voice in the mist. This whole dialogue is something that I want to put as a quote on my wall and memorize that because it's so meaningful to life now. To end, I think that my final impressions of Narnia are that it's doubly meaningful for me. It was a childhood thing, and I have memories of it when I was really happy and young, and also really very heartbroken and young. It also has grown with me as I've gotten older. It's deepened my faith in Jesus Christ with Aslan and what C.S. Lewis has put into the books with some of the symbolism, and also just the entire world in the sense of northernness that Lewis was focused on. It showed me that kind of aspect in my own life. It's given me hope too, because even though I might not enter a wardrobe like I did as a child, there's always still hope of new and, dare I say it, magical things around the corner. There's always good stories and happy story endings, victorious story endings, even when you've forgotten what you need to remember or you're in a moment of darkness like in The Silver Chair. There are going to be life struggles and victories and surprising allies and friends and enemies to be had, but always Aslan's voice, even though he goes by a different name here. So, good luck everyone on your Narnia journeys.
If you want to share what the Chronicles of Narnia means to you, Send your voice to the email address in the episode description.
This is your C.S. Lewis Minute. I'm William O'Flaherty from EssentialCSLewis.com. In earlier episodes, I told you about Lewis's three-part series of science fiction works that are collectively called the Space Trilogy, but some refer to it as the Ransom Trilogy. The final book, That Hideous Strength, was detailed last time, but I'm specifically referencing it today because Lewis wrote an interesting essay called The Inner Ring that has some connection to it. Initially a talk given in 1944, The Inner Ring, a shorter work found in the essay collection The Weight of Glory, warns of an unhealthy desire to be part of an informal group that really controls things in an organization. Mark Studdick in That Hideous Strength found being part of an inner ring only leads to trouble and doesn't fulfill you like you think it might. So pick up The Weight of Glory essay collection to read The Inner Ring and other interesting articles. Learn more about the creator of Narnia at my website, EssentialCSLewis.com. Again, I'm William O'Flaherty.
All right, your turn to get stumped now, potentially.
Okay, go over it again.
Let's stump a Narnia Webber here. So your question is, on what three objects is the deep magic from the dawn of time engraved? And if you want, you can blow Queen Susan's horn and ask for a hint.
I'm going to blow Queen Susan's horn and I need a hint because I didn't even take it last time. Maybe that would have helped.
Okay, do you know any of them that it's engraved on?
It's engraved on the stone table.
Okay.
I'm not going to give my final answer right now. I think the one is, it has to do with something like the stone table, the emperor's scepter, the emperor over the sea. I think he has a scepter. I think that it's engraved on.
And this is the scene, of course, in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, where the White Witch comes to Aslan and is basically saying, you know, you have a traitor there, Aslan. And she, you know, talks about the deep magic and the objects it's engraved on. So you're going to blow Queen Susan's horn. So the stone table you already got. For the next object, it is engraved as deep as a spear is long.
That's the second object.
Right.
Does this mean you give a hint for a third object?
It does. So I wanted to give you a chance to soak that in. So for the third object, the final object belongs to a ruler who is never directly seen in the books but is referred to on multiple occasions.
I think it's on the scepter of the emperor over the sea. Stone table. Steep as a spear is long. Yeah, I remember that line, but that's the most memorable part of the line is
right.
Engraved as deep as a spear is long.
So I'll go ahead and tell you right now that you've got the stone table and you've got the scepter of the emperor beyond the sea.
Yeah.
Those two are correct. Yeah. So the final one is engraved as deep as a spear is long on this object. Mm-hmm. And let me leave you here to mull this over. Yep. I think that this might be a little bit different in the pre-1994 American text. I want to check this. I'll be right back.
Okay. Din 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 din. Sorry. He runs really fast, by the way, when he's running to get a Narnia book.
And I'm back. What I missed?
Oh, cool. Oh. Nothing. I didn't say anything.
Okay, well, I'm the editor, so I'll get there sooner or later. But anyway, so for those of you that don't know, there are multiple editions of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Multiple editions.
I'm looking at a version that was out of print because Lewis had his original text, then he, that was, you know, published in the UK, then sometime later when they were published in the United States, he made a few tweaks. And in 1994, when HarperCollins took over the publishing, they got rid of those editions so it would be a standard edition worldwide. But if I go to a pre-1994 American edition of the book, I'm pretty sure it will read something a little bit different. But whatever. Why don't you just go ahead and give me your answer?
Okay. I think it has... I don't know why I'm thinking this. I have no idea. It's coming from the crazy part of my brain. I think it's engraved on hills. I don't know why, but something, I think it's engraved in hills.
Want me to go ahead and tell you the answer?
Yeah, go ahead.
You got the stone table, you got the scepter of the Emperor Beyond the Sea, and the final one is on the firestones of the secret hill. So not bad.
Oh, so it's one hill.
But yeah, you just had the fire. You just had the firestones.
That's
part,
very specific. Yeah, I wanted to say hills for some reason, but I guess it was, I guess I had the word hill.
Right. Let me take
a quick. 66% isn't too terrible.
I'm looking at my pre-1994 American edition, and it says, "Let us say I have forgotten it," answered Aslan gravely. "Tell us of this deep magic." "Tell you," said the witch, her voice growing suddenly shriller. "Tell you what is written on that very table of stone which stands beside us. Tell you what is written in letters as deep as a spear as long on the trunk of the world ash tree." I knew it.
Whoa.
I
just remember that.
So that's totally different. But so the other two have always been there. But yeah, it's in pre-1994 American edition of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. It's the world ash tree.
Interesting. That's some World of Warcraft sized trees right there.
Don't know why he decided to tweak that.
Yeah, I like Firestone of the Secret Hill a lot better. Anyway.
Yeah, I think I like that a little better.
Huh. That's a tough one. That's a tough stump question.
That's a pretty tough one. I'll give you that. Hey, you basically got, you got two of them. You almost got the third one. So props.
Yeah. Thanks. All right. Well, that was fun. I'm burned out.
All right. Yeah, I imagine you are pretty burned out. But I guess I'll go ahead and take the outro. You deserve it after that stump question.
Thanks, Glenfuddle. I appreciate it.
Maybe I'll. So how would Lacerilene read the outro?
Yeah, yeah. Listen up, boys and girls. We're going to air something special.
You've been listening to Talking Beast, a NarniaWeb.com podcast, darling. Be sure to subscribe and post a comment below or in the Talking Beast Facebook group. It's simply delightful. You can also email us at podcasts@narniaweb.com, realian@narniaweb.com, or glumpuddle@narniaweb.com. Special thanks to AJ Aiken, Ryidian, and the Rose Tree Dryad. For the latest news on the Silver Chair movie, visit narniaweb.com. A new episode of Talking Beast is posted every other Tuesday. Until next time, further up and further in.
My life will never be the same again. Thank you for that.
Filmmakers, if you're looking for someone to play Lacerilene, Brian Carnell, Glumpuddle at NarniaWeb.com.
For the alien race of Kalorman.
Okay, let's let this one go.